It's the 8th of June 2012 and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Why didn't Israeli commandos storm the Queen's flotilla last Sunday? Why does the government promote slave labour, and how many fifths of a person does a Jubilee steward count as? How illuminating was the Enlightenment Cafe? And when you challenge misleading faith-healing claims, does the advertising regulator have to rule on the existence of God? But first, the regular begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then do head over to our website and subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us pay all of the costs for the podcast, such as the bandwidth bills for downloading. We're now picking up the tab on the bandwidth directly, so all donations are greatly appreciated. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. But now let's get on with the show. And perhaps inevitably this week, we must first dwell upon the Queen's Diamond Jubilee. If you switched on the TV last week, then chances are that you saw the sickeningly sycophantic coverage of a thoroughly unremarkable old woman continuing to live. I think the most bewildering point was when the commentator said, over pictures of the Queen grimacing in the rain on a boat, that she was beaming. That's right, beaming. It got me so angry that this week we're going to provide the counterpoint to the BBC coverage and give voice to some Republicans. In protest, we're going to provide some relentlessly negative coverage of the royal family. It's important because that twat Prince Charles is next, and he's perhaps the ugliest member of the House of Windsor. Or should I say, the House of Loser. Yeah, that's negative enough, isn't it? Anyway, we tried to get down to the anti-monarchy protest organised by Republic during a flotilla last Sunday, but we were unable to after security claimed that the Riverside area was full. They said this with a straight face despite hundreds of square metres of empty pavement behind them. Just goes to show, slave labour, you get what you pay for. But anyway, we did manage to bump into Jim Jepps from the London Big Smoke blog, who was also trying to get through to the protest. Okay, so Jim Jepps from the Big Smoke London blog, you're here trying to get into the Republic protest, or at least by the river as well.
Yep.
I mean, what do you make of the situation? Maybe I'm just trying to stir things up and say, is it deliberate attempts to stifle dissent, or are they just being incompetent?
Yes, you're a communist troublemaker. The police are saying that it's full to capacity, which is a really interesting thing to say when we can see loads of space. Surely we should be, you know, there's no health and safety issue, there's no kind of crowd issue there, as far as I can see. So they've allowed this tiny amount of kind of protest, I guess, which is, I assume, diluted by quite a lot of monarchists. I was listening to Six Music just before I came out, and they had a really interesting news piece, because they had a news piece about the flotilla and how wonderful the Queen is and all of that. And I was kind of like starting to feel slightly nauseous. And then they said, oh, and there's a public demonstration as well. And I thought, ah, a little bit of balance, that's great. And so they interviewed a monarchist about why the Republic demonstration was wrong and bad, and how Republicans are all awful people. And that was the end of the news.
Oh.
So the balance was, you know, here's the monarchist side of the story, and here's the monarchist side of the story about Republicans. it's a really interesting interesting thing. But, I mean, essentially, I was talking to a couple of people here who come down to support the Queen. And what they were saying was really interesting, because basically they couldn't get in either. They were basically saying, you know, well, they want us to support the Queen, but then they say it's not for us, we're not part of... The woman used was, we're not part of the elite. And they decided to go off, go home in a huff. And it's exactly the same issue around the Olympics, where it's taking place here, but we're not invited.
I guess by the time this programme goes out, we'll know that if this has developed into sort of a fully-fledged PR disaster, because it seems to be there's thousands of people, certainly on Tooley Street, who can't get to the river, whoever side they're on.
I don't know. I'm not sure we'll ever know whether it's a PR disaster. What we do know is that we've had wall-to-wall coverage of the monarchy on the telly. We've had no real dissenting voices on any of our kind of media. The most popular papers are all basically pushing the monarchist line. And yet I walk around London and I've seen a little bit of bunting in squares and official places where basically agencies have put them up. I haven't seen nearly as many flags as I do during the World Cup. during any of the kind of sporting events which people feel they are part of. So actually, although I don't think we're ever going to see any evidence of whether this was a PR disaster for them or not, I think we've got a lot of people who are annoyed at the wall-to-wall coverage, so they missed their favourite soap or their whatever. And it's really not cutting with people, because people actually aren't taking part in that kind of festival in the way that they're meant to be. I think we're all meant to have flags in our windows and be wearing kind of paper crowns and whatever it is. And that's simply not happening. What people are, I mean, there's quite a few people here today, and I think they want to see the spectacular flotilla.
Mm.
And I would be quite interested to see that myself. You don't see flotillas very often.
Exactly. I was hoping that by going to the protest, we could have our cake and eat it, so we could protest and stick it to the monarchy, where also see the quite interesting spectacle of all the boats.
Yeah. But, well, you know, I want to see that. My mum rang me up just now and said, do take pictures of the boats.
Mm.
So I'll see whether I even get to see the river today. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think the way they've pretended there are no Republicans, pretended that everyone's in favour of the Queen, I think that will backfire on them, even though we won't necessarily see that as ripples in the press.
Mm. Jim Jeffs, thank you very much, and thank you for your opinions on the spot.
My pleasure.
Thank you. So we missed out on getting some stuff from the Republic protest on the day, but yesterday I managed to catch up with James Gray, who's a writer and campaigner who helped organise the Republic protest, to get his perspective on the Jubilee weekend. I started by asking him about his experiences with security at the protest.
Well, it was fine for us because we were there very early in the morning. But, I mean, I should say that we met with More London, who are the private company who own that area. And we were in contact with them for a number of months, actually. And not once did they tell us that there was going to be a problem with capacity. So we really thought they weren't front with us. But what happened is that around 200 or 300 people got in, and then they completely blocked off that area. So a kind of impromptu protest, and a much bigger one, several hundred people formed outside on Tooley Street. And that seemed to be the one that was more fun.
It seemed that they were being a bit overzealous, because we got there trying to get through, and they said there's no room. And behind the people saying there was no room, there was acres and acres of free space. It was just very odd.
There was lots of room, and the police, I should say, were actually really, really good, and they were really, really helpful. But unfortunately, it is a private company. They own that land, and they can pretty much do what they like. I mean, they tried to confiscate placards and banners and things like that. We knew our rights. We knew that they couldn't actually do that. So we held on to ours. But lots of people just gave in and just handed them over. So it really wasn't good. More London didn't come out of this looking particularly good. But I should just repeat that the police were very helpful and were very keen and supportive of facilitating the protest.
Why did Republic feel the need to protest the flotilla in the first place?
The main point was really just to show that there is a Republican movement in this country. There's a campaign that people can join. And we thought, you know, what better way of saying that to the nation than being right there at the heart of a royal event? We actually had a Republican street party at the time of the royal wedding, because we felt that it was a wedding and it would, you know, a protest wouldn't be suitable. So we had a kind of fun family street party, and that went really well. But this time we thought, you know, this is really a very serious political statement, the Jubilee. It's a kind of forced celebration of as we would say, you know, hereditary power and privilege, and we wanted to kind of counter that in a very forceful and vocal way.
One of the accusations I got levelled at me over the weekend, I got into a number of Facebook arguments about it, was that I was being a killjoy by complaining about the Jubilee celebrations. I mean, what do you think the best sort of Republican comeback to that is?
Well, I mean, obviously we always knew we were going to be accused of being killjoys. But, you know, it was a very serious point that we're making. You know, this is about the way we do politics. It's about democracy. And so that is serious. You know, it's not always about, you know, having fun. But I would just say that the atmosphere was really, really good. And actually we were getting into lots of very friendly debates with monarchists. There was a good atmosphere. It was a family atmosphere. We weren't actually stopping anyone having any fun at all. In fact, I think we probably converted a few people who had just come along. Perhaps they weren't staunch monarchists in the first place, but they'd just come along to watch the flotilla. They got engaged in debate, and they'll probably, you know, think a bit more about the issues and look at the website and maybe even sign up.
I guess that's the interesting thing. I mean, at the moment, there's suggestions that polls say the monarchy is more popular than, you know, there have been for many years at the moment. Do you think it's a particularly challenging protesting in this current climate? I mean, considering, I think, I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head, but if like 90% of the public like the monarchy, is that not a difficult argument to win?
Well, first of all, I would say that it's not 90% like the monarchy. I mean, consistently, it's around 20 to 25%. There were loads and loads of polls done in the run-up to the Jubilee, and one of them came out, put republicanism at 13%. All the others put it around 20%. So it really does depend on picking out the one that looks worse for us. But that doesn't mean that all the other people, you know, the 80%, are monarchists. What that tends to mean is that, you know, most people are generally happy with the status quo. If you give them an option of, you know, does it make any difference to you, lots of people would choose that. There's also lots of don't knows. I would say that the people who are really, really staunch monarchists are probably, there's probably about the same number of them as there are staunch Republicans. There's a lot of people in the middle who, you know, are generally happy with the current arrangement, but they certainly, you know, they perhaps wouldn't like Charles. Maybe they want a choice over, you know, whether it should be William. Maybe they're annoyed about the royal spending. Maybe they've got concerns about transparency. So I would always say that the view of the British public is a nuanced one. And it's not simply a case of, you know, overwhelming support for the monarchy against a tiny minority of Republicans. It's much more complicated than that.
I mean, I think one of the polls I did think was interesting was, I think ITV News reported on one which suggested that 40% of people want William to take over next. And I just wonder how many of those people have thought, well, maybe we should have a better selection mechanism.
Well, exactly. I mean, what we're seeing is that the monarchy is no longer seen as a hereditary institution. It's seen, well, most of the time, actually, it's seen as the Queen, and that's it. But I think when people look forward to the future, they think, well, maybe we should have an element of choice. But if you want to choose, then essentially you're a Republican. So again, it comes back to this idea that you know, public opinion is actually quite complex on this.
As a Republican, do you think it's just a case of biding our time until, how can I put this politely, Charles takes over? Because, you know, he seems much less popular.
It's definitely not about biding our time. It's about building a movement now, putting these campaigning structures in place. So, you know, kind of creating local groups, for instance, publishing research, doing the investigations into the monarchy, building up support, building up a media profile, all those kind of things. You can't sit around and wait for the Queen to die and then suddenly do them. You have to do them now. I mean, of course, you know, the Queen dying is going to be a big opportunity for us. I mean, Charles is loathed by lots of the population. He's viewed with suspicion by many more. And so, of course, that is an opportunity, and, you know, it would be ridiculous to deny that. But now is the time to start working on it. You know, this is the time to build up a movement. And what we saw on Sunday was actually a really historic moment. This has never happened before in modern times. There's never been an anti-monarchy protest like that. So, you know, we've got over 1,000 people there. You know, that really is the start of something. And so the challenge now is to keep building on that.
Is this a new level of support for Republic as an organised movement? How organised is the Republican movement? Is it they're ready to take over, or does it still need a lot of work?
Well, I mean, I suppose I would say that, you know, it's not about Republic as an organisation kind of taking over anything. It's about, you know, Republic exists to change public opinion and to get a debate going and to really get people to start thinking critically about the monarchy. But what we have seen in the last year is Republic supporter base, you know, double from, you know, a few thousand to, like, I would say just after Jubilee weekend, it's probably more like 25, 30,000 now. So this is a growing campaign, and it's a growing movement. But what it needs is, you know, it's no good people just kind of getting involved in Facebook or going on protest, you know, going on a Central London protest. What we need is for people to get involved in their local areas, to start kind of just being open about being a Republican and not hiding those feelings anymore. And I think when we see people having the confidence to do that, then we'll start to see public opinion shifting.
Do you think Republicanism, there are rational arguments for it, or is it something you have to sort of be persuaded on a values or an ideological level to be a supporter of? Or can we go, here's some evidence, here's some numbers, which is why?
Well, I mean, I think he's always going to have, it's always going to be about ideology. It's always going to be, you know, do you support democracy and popular sovereignty, or do you support, you know, a kind of traditionalist view of how societies should be structured and ordered? But, I mean, what I would say is that, you know, if you look at the Constitution, we're often told that, you know, the Queen somehow stops dictators coming to power and all those kind of myths. If you actually look at it, you know, it's kind of quite a dry argument. But if you have an elected head of state, then they can actually, you know, act as a check on the power of the government, you know, which is something that we just can't have now. And that, to me, seems like a very rational way of looking at government. You know, you need these safeguards. And at the moment, we just don't have them.
So on that note, if anyone listening is interested and would like to get more involved in Republic and republicanism in general, what's the best thing that people listening can do?
Well, I would say go on republic.org.uk, have a look at, you know, the case that we're putting forward. Follow us on Twitter. It's at Republic Staff. On Facebook, it's Republic Campaign. The really important thing is that if you agree with what Republic's saying and you agree with the Republican cause, go out there and talk to people about it and start getting those arguments and debates happening. And then, you know, we'll start to see a change in how people view the monarchy, and we'll get them to ask critical questions about it.
Lovely. And we'll leave it there. James Gray, thank you very much. Oddly enough, for a weekend that had been carefully stage-managed throughout, there was one unexpected outcome. And that's that the most horrifying story wasn't, in fact, the doping of the general public by a subservient media into losing sight of their own weakened position in society, and instead lulled into participating in a volkish worship of the entrenched rich and privileged classes. The most horrifying story might actually have been the slave labour used by the Jubilee organisers under the guise of the government's workfare programme. But what exactly is the workfare programme? Corey Hazlehurst has been finding out.
What, if anything, do the Jubilee celebrations tell us about modern Britain? If one story broken by The Guardian is anything to go by, then we are in a very sorry state indeed. Shiv Malik reported that Close Protection UK used around 30 job seekers and 50 apprentices to steward the Jubilee events, including the flotilla on the River Thames. Some of those stewards told The Guardian that they had to camp under bridges the night before the pageant, change into their security clothes in public, had no access to toilets for 24 hours, and work a 14-hour shift in the pouring rain. The job seekers were not paid for their work, whilst the apprentices were paid £2.80 an hour. In their defence, Close Protection UK has said that the workers received training, an NVQ Level 2 qualification in spectator safety, and were allowed to keep their clothes, which, as far as I can gather, were a pair of combat boots, some trousers, a high-vis jacket, and a see-through plastic poncho. So let me get this straight. The government paid a firm £1.5 million to provide adequate stewarding for the Jubilee. Rather than actually pay people a fair day's pay for a fair day's work, that firm bussed in a load of unemployed people from all over the country, forced them to sleep rough, and didn't pay them a damn thing. All this to support a celebration held in the honour of a woman whose personal fortune is estimated at £290 million. If there is a starker example of the inequality and unfairness of modern Britain, I have yet to hear it. These people were part of the government's work programme, or workfare, as it's being called by critics. This incident therefore seems the perfect opportunity to examine the workfare scheme. Workfare is slightly different to traditional welfare models. Under older welfare systems, job seekers would continue to receive benefits as long as they could prove that they were searching for work. Workfare means that recipients of benefits must meet certain requirements to receive them. These requirements could be to attend training or work experience, or to do low or unpaid work. The Australian Workfare Programme puts it very bluntly. It's called work for the dole. The term workfare was popularised in the 1969 speech by Richard Nixon. However, as James Peck wrote in his book, Workfare States, 30 years ago, workfare was mainly the preserve of a small but influential group of right-wing American intellectuals. Since then, it's moved from an ivory tower into practical policy in many different countries. These include the Netherlands, Denmark, Canada, and America, especially under Bill Clinton. In Britain, although John Major introduced small-scale workfare trials, it was New Labour who introduced the concept further to Britain's welfare system. Peck argues that Blair went further than Thatcher in enforcing work requirements on the unemployed. In 1999, for instance, the Child Poverty Action Group warned that Britain was heading towards a US-style workfare system. Under the New Deal, single parents and those with a disability would have to attend repeated advice interviews for jobs, or else lose their benefits. The then Social Security Secretary, Alistair Darling, said that these proposals were harsh, but justifiable. The Coalition's Work Experience Programme expands this further. There are several slightly different schemes. For instance, there's a voluntary work experience scheme for 16 to 24-year-olds who've been unemployed for between 3 and 9 months. They work unpaid for between 2 and 8 weeks for 25 to 30 hours a week. There's also a mandatory work activity for long-term job seekers aged over 24 who engage in work which makes a contribution to the community. The stewards were part of the work programme. This is a scheme for those over 24 who have been unemployed for over a year, or who are aged 16 to 24 and have been unemployed for 9 months. A number of private companies are being paid £3 to £5 billion over 7 years to get people back into work and then keep them in work. Last year, a Social Security Advisory Committee report on the Mandatory Work Activity Programme recommended to the government that the scheme should not proceed. They raised a number of concerns that the scheme was bad for job seekers and for workers. By limiting the amount of time job seekers have to look for work, the committee thought that this might actually lead to those on the scheme having less chance of getting a job. Remember also that the jobs on the Mandatory Work Activity Programme were meant to make a contribution to the community. The committee found that this definition was too vague and often led to the private company who were being paid to find work for job seekers having to come up with a definition. They asked for a definition of jobs that could benefit the community, and the committee were given a list of things which included working for the profit of the host company. Finally, the committee were also concerned that these schemes might undercut the wages of full-time workers. A company could, instead of employing another member of staff, take on a job seeker every 4 weeks and therefore fill a post at no cost. Many private companies are indeed taking on job seekers to reduce their employment costs. Tesco last year took on 3,000 18 to 24-year-olds to undertake work that could otherwise be done by full-time staff. Therefore, instead of young people under 21 receiving the minimum wage of £4.98 an hour, they were being paid £1.78 an hour, if we assume they're working for 30 hours a week, with the current JSA allowance being £53.45 a week for 18 to 24-year-olds. This is exploitation, pure and simple, as well as denying jobs to people who would otherwise be being paid by Tesco. Organisations such as Boycott Workfare and Corporate Watch have found many such stories. For instance, there are reports that Holland and Barrett are not paying staff overtime because those on Workfare are working the hours instead. There are also stories that Asda sent paid staff home early over Christmas and New Year and instead used Workfare to fill the gaps. Not only does this mean that workers are earning less, since they're being denied the chance to work for extra pay at higher rates, but it might also have implications for workers' tax credits. Labour MP Fiona McTaggart has said that since companies can use Workfare to depress the hours their part-time workers actually do, they may no longer be eligible for tax credits to top up their income. Finally, there's no real evidence that Workfare actually works. Indeed, the rates at which those on the Work Experience Programme come off job seekers' allowance is very similar to that of ordinary job seekers. The Social Security Advisory Committee report I mentioned earlier said that, and I quote, "Published evidence is at best ambivalent about the chances of workfare-type activity improving outcomes for people who are out of work. This evidence suggests that the mandatory work activity must be carefully tailored to an individual's specific needs," end of quote. And this is not what we're seeing with the government's work programme. In summary, people should be paid more than one poncho for working a 14-hour shift. This was Corey Hazelhurst for The Pod Delusion.
Now, you may remember a couple of weeks ago, we trailed an event taking place at the Old Vic Tunnels in London called the Enlightenment Cafe, an interactive theatre experience that merges talks on science and rationalism with a Victorian aesthetic. Well, last week we went along to see how the event would play out and caught up with the producer, Andy Franz-Koviak, and performer Claire Benson. So we're here with Andy Franz-Koviak, the producer of the Enlightenment Cafe, and Claire Benson, who's one of the performers. We've been at the event all evening, and it's been a remarkable experience. But I've been trying to nail down, is this theatre? Is this an exhibition? What is it we're enjoying? I can't work it out.
Well, I guess it's the Enlightenment Cafe, and I think that it is all of those things. It's supposed to be a theatre experience, it's supposed to be science, it's supposed to be just a world that people come into and they can find themselves doing a whole raft of different things, some of the highest sort of science, where they're sort of learning from people like Claire, who is actually obviously a scientist, or an astronomer, a genuine astronomer, or they can find themselves with a couple of performers taking part in anthropometric sort of examinations of their breath speed and stuff like that. And it's wholly about all of these things. So the Enlightenment Cafe has actually worked as unbelievably well. We've been so impressed with how everybody's taken to it, all of the performers, all of the scientists, everybody has just absolutely astounded us, and it's their energy and their excitement and enthusiasm and passion and all these words that is wholly driving this thing. All that we've done is put them all together in one space, put a little bit of sort of Victorian dressing on it and sort of said go, and it's just sort of, it's gone.
And this is day three of four. How's it going? Is it getting the same buzz every night? Is it all going really well?
Or? It's going fabulously well. We've actually had a very different audience every night, which is really interesting. You sort of, like, having worked in the theatre a long time as I have, you sort of get an understanding for what a Friday night audience is like, a Saturday night audience is like. So you are prepared a little bit for the end of working week Friday night audience that are a bit more rah, let's go for it, and they were like that, absolutely. But every audience in their own way has wholly embraced the Enlightenment Cafe and has really sort of taken to, they've been captivated by what they've been hearing, or they've really thrown themselves into any of the sort of participatory sort of bits, whether that's sort of soapbox lectures, whether that's being potentially a psychic, bearing in mind what obviously a psychic means and everything like that. But so everyone's really sort of embraced it, and it's just been, yeah, we've been really
how much training did you give all the performers? Like how much did you tell Claire to do, because you're from a theatre background, Claire's from a science background, did you have to say you need to act, or how did you sort of coach everyone into what doing things?
Claire's been under our wings for several years now, sort of like training her to get to this place. No, that's not true. She's no we didn't have to do, genuinely all we did was gave them the concept and asked them what they wanted to talk about, what they found really interesting, and the rest would be done by their own passion, and that's really as simple as it is.
How have the crowds been? Like we've been sitting through some of the group lectures, and we've sat in some of the other ones, but the questions are really interesting from what seems to be a really general audience. Have you got any really tough questions?
The only tough question I got actually was about fire brigades from other countries, which I've only ever dealt with the fire brigade from this one, and I've never actually thought of dealing with others. Ridiculous, of course, but no, the others, you're right, the audience have been incredible. They've been coming up after the shows and asking lots of detailed questions, and it's lovely to find people who are obviously complete laymen, who know very little about science, saying, what is that chemical? Why is it making that? I'm burning some chemicals and doing some flame test type stuff, and then people are coming and saying, so is that how they do fireworks? It's like, yeah, exactly the same. It's lovely to tell them that stuff.
How have you found the Victorian setting? Are you enjoying the costume and the sort of implicit, the sort of more wild west of science back then, because it's not as regular, the health and safety, I assume, wasn't much of an issue back then and stuff like that.
No, but of course it has been a bit of an issue tonight. It's been really inspirational. Of course, the 19th century, just amazing advances in science and engineering. And that, I think that's what really inspired me when they said they were going for this era. And I started reading up and thinking about things that I love from this era. And I realised how much things moved on, right from Dalton with his atomic theory, developing different ideas of using fire and different kinds of explosives. It's just an incredible time.
was going to say, when it was heard that you were doing fire underneath Waterloo Station, were any questions raised there?
I just wasn't allowed to bring large gas cylinders in because they were rather concerned I was going to blow up Waterloo Station just before the Olympics.
That would be awkward, wouldn't it? Anyway, we'll let you get on with the evening. It's been amazing. Andy Francescovia, Claire Benton, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, next up, we've got a report by Hayley Stevens, who tells us the inside story of how and why she complained to the Advertising Standards Authority about a faith healing group making allegedly misleading health claims. You might remember it did make the news, as there was a cross-party letter sent by three MPs to the ASA in which they defended the power of prayer. One of the signatories was Liberal Democrat President Tim Farron, and to be fair, prayer is about the only hope Lib Dems have left at the next election. But anyway, here's Hayley Stevens to tell us more.
I had been suffering with terrible pain in my right ear for about 4 years before a doctor standing in for my regular doctor noticed that I had a massive growth in there, a condition called cholesteatoma. A few weeks after that, I saw an ENT specialist and was told that if it wasn't operated on within 3 months, I'd probably get meningitis, facial paralysis, and possibly a brain tumour, and then I'd die. His words were, "You have two options. Have the operation and get better, or don't have the operation, become very ill and die." I remember that I laughed at his frankness, and then he hadn't laughed back, and I'd realised it was serious. I don't know if you've ever been faced with your own imminent death, but when it happens, you often get very frustrated. I was in constant pain and had to wait over 2 months until I was operated upon. I don't think I'll ever put into words how scared I was, or how desperate I was. I would have done anything to speed up my chance of surviving. Luckily for me, though, I was too poor to buy any alternative treatments offered by well-meaning friends and colleagues. I couldn't afford to buy magnetic bracelets, to have acupuncture, or to take homeopathic remedies or visit the local psychic healer. It's that whole experience that made me aware of people who offer others false hope when they're quite unwell. There's no shortage of people who offer miracle cures to those with terminal illnesses or incurable diseases. Some of the time they're misguided themselves and genuinely mean well, but other times they're leeching off the misfortune of others and making a fast profit in doing so. Because of this, I make a habit of collecting leaflets, cutting adverts out of magazines and newspapers, and taking business cards from people who offer such cures, so that I can report them to Trading Standards or the Advertising Standards Authority. It makes me sound like a loser with nothing better to do, but because I've been the person who would have willingly paid good money to be magically cured of my illness while facing my own death, I see these adverts and think about how a younger me with a growth in her ear would have reacted. I think of those I know who are terminally ill, or those I've lost as a result of illness or disease, and I do what I can to stop those vulnerable because of their ill health being exploited or hurt. Last year, on a visit to the city of Bath, I became aware of a group of people who called themselves Healing on the Streets, or HOTS for short, who are outside the Abbey offering to help people with various illnesses by praying for them to be healed by God. I was quite concerned at the claims I found on the leaflets they were handing out about illnesses and conditions that this group seemed to be promoting as healable through prayer. Cancer, MS, paralysis, crippling disease, addiction, asthma, depression and more. I knew that normally I would report such claims to the ASA as I had in the past with local psychic healers and homeopaths and chiropractors, but at the same time I became conflicted about what to do next because I knew that no matter what I did, I'd be accused by people of being anti-religious. I stalled on acting upon the claims, but as time passed I saw the group at work again and I also became of their YouTube videos in which even more claims were made. And I realised that I didn't feel comfortable with not expressing my concern to people who might be able to do something about the claims if they agreed something was wrong. That's when I made the complaint to the Advertising Standards Authority. I complained that the claim that the advertisers could heal the name conditions was misleading and could not be substantiated, that the testimonials on their website and YouTube misleadingly implied that the advertiser could heal the conditions referred to, and that the ads were irresponsible because they provided false hope to those suffering from the named conditions. Months later, the ASA got in touch to say they'd made a decision about the complaint. Not only did they uphold my complaint, but they'd added to it, challenging whether the ads could discourage essential treatment for conditions for which medical supervision should be sought. In response to the ASA, the healing group said there were no claims in the ads that HOTS or any individual person could heal the conditions referred to. They said the leaflet stated, "God can heal you," which was a statement of their belief. They also said that they did not believe the ads were irresponsible or providing false hope to people who were sick. In their view, any hope provided was not false because they believed that God could and did heal sickness, and that many people had experienced that. They offered to amend the ads to state, "We believe God can heal," and "See God heal the sick," or "Pray for the sick," and to include the words "we believe" in any references to healing. They also offered to include a prominent reference to medical treatment on their website and to remove the leaflet from their website. Although the ASA acknowledged that HOTS sought to promote their faith and the hope for physical healing by God through the claims in their ads, they were concerned that the prominent references to healing and the statements "you have nothing to lose except your sickness," in combination with the references to medical conditions for which medical supervision should be sought, such as arthritis, asthma, MS, addiction, depression, and a paralysis, could give consumers the expectation that by receiving prayer from HOTS volunteers, they would be healed of the conditions listed or other sicknesses from which they suffered. Even though HOTS had offered to make amendments to the ad and to remove the leaflet from their website, the ASA considered that their suggested amendments were not sufficient for the ads to comply with the CAP codes. As a result, my complaint was upheld, and HOTS were told that the ads must not appear again in their current form. They told HOTS not to make claims which stated or implied, by receiving prayer from their volunteers, people could be healed of medical conditions, and told them not to refer in their ads to medical conditions for which medical supervision should be sought. I was glad that the ASA could see my points and agreed that the claims could certainly be perceived as a last hope for those with serious illness. In response to this decision, the Healing on the Streets group wrote about the outcome on their website and how they were going to appeal the decision. They also blamed the complaint on what they described as a group generally opposed to Christianity, meaning the National Secular Society. I felt bad that someone else was being blamed for something I had done, but I thought twice about making it known that I was the person who had complained, because in the past I've been harassed by those I've complained about, and with this group being based in Bath, they were very close to home. Yet the reaction from HOTS made me decide against remaining anonymous, simply so that I could answer the accusations raised in the statement on their website. As the person who made the complaint, I was the only one who could state that the complaint was not made on the grounds of the religion of those making the claims as they had stated, but because of the claims they were making about specific illnesses. I felt HOTS were being irresponsible because they do not know if the people they encourage to pray for healing from their God is someone who mistrusts their doctor, which sadly many people do. And even though they apparently give out a letter telling people to carry on with their medication or treatment, there is potential there for damage to be done once that person leaves the company of the HOTS volunteers. I have no issue with people praying for the healing of others in their own personal way, and if you believe your God can cure somebody, then I'm truly glad that you have such faith. But I object to that being pushed onto other people as a genuine potential cure, especially when they're vulnerable and desperate. Despite outlining this on my personal blog, national newspapers picked up on the story and focused on me being an atheist and Christians being persecuted because of their beliefs. The Daily Mail started the trend of referring to me as atheist Hayley Stevens, who had used the ASA as some sort of weapon, despite the fact that my non-belief defines me just as much as my love of strawberry jelly does. My website, Facebook account and email were all flooded with comments from people accusing me of having an atheist agenda. I appeared twice on local news stations explaining why I had made the complaint, but to no avail because someone found out where I worked, despite the fact that I keep it a secret, and told my employer that they should not be hiring somebody like me. I was contacted by the ASA earlier this year to explain that the adjudication decision had been appealed by HOTS, and I had to give a statement outlining why I'd made the complaint. Earlier this week, the people conducting the appeal reached a decision and upheld the original conclusion of the ASA. The Healing on the Streets group were told they still were not allowed to make claims about specific illnesses on their leaflets. Shortly after this was announced, somebody sent me a scanned picture of the newly designed Healing on the Streets leaflet. Gone is the list of diseases and terminal conditions they believe God can cure, and added was a disclaimer that reads, We would advise those who receive prayer and feel there is a notable change in their health that they seek a doctor's verification and advice before making any changes to the medication they receive for a condition. Many people still explained to me that I was wrong to make the complaint and that I was overreacting. But the words of a stranger who recognised me in the shop after I had just been on the news convinced me that I wasn't wrong. He approached me and asked if I'd just been on the local news about the healers in Bath. I thought he was going to shout at me, but instead, when I said it was me, he smiled and told me his wife had died a few months before from terminal cancer, and she had been so ill and so desperate to live that she would have tried anything. He said to me, "We need people like you who are willing to stand up and speak out for those who can't speak out for themselves." And that's why I plan to continue doing so. My collection of leaflets and adverts cut out of magazines is always growing, and now my friends and family and neighbours collect them for me too. My experience of healing on the streets has helped to raise awareness, amongst others, about misleading health claims and what you can do about them, which can only be a good thing. Here's to many more successful adjudications. Oh, and I survived the cholesteatoma, by the way, even when it came back a second time. Thank God for science-based medicine.
Now, it turns out that Barry Gibb is rather interested in brains. Unfortunately, I'm not talking about the one remaining BG, you know, the one who is actually quite good at staying alive, but the neuroscientist of the same name. The revised edition of his book, The Rough Guide to the Brain, has just been released, so we thought we'd get our resident neuroscientist, Dean Burnett, to have a chat with him. Incidentally, we're thinking of following in the rich tradition of video games and offering a zombie-themed Pod Delusion expansion pack. So if you'd like the zombie expansion pack, just play this next report at half speed. Then Barry and Dean will hopefully sound like zombies, just saying, you know, brains, brains, quite a lot. Here's Dean and Barry.
Okay, this is Dean Burnett for the Pod Delusion. I'm here at the Wellcome Trust with Dr. Barry Gibb.
Good afternoon.
To talk about his latest book, I believe. So, Barry, give us a bit of background about yourself for a start, just to make sure we know who we're talking to here.
All right, Dean. Well, essentially, I started life as a normal scientist.
No such thing, but carry on.
Indeed. And, you know, I did the usual thing. Went to university, PhD, did some postdoctoral research all around the area of neuroscience. But then after about 10, 11 years of that, I decided that I wanted to both make films and write. So whilst I was freelance, there was an opportunity came along from Rough Guide to suggest several titles, things that they might want someone to write. So I wrote to them and I gave them my four titles, one of which was Rough Guide to the Brain. Nothing happened for about 3 months, but then they got back to me and sure enough wanted to meet me for lunch. And I thought, well, this is all lovely, getting taken for lunch. It was Italian. It was cannelloni, I remember.
Oh, and it must be a very rare thing to happen then.
It absolutely is, yeah. Especially when you're freelance.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course.
I take every free meal you can get. During the meal, Andrew Lockett, the editor, basically said, well, would you do it? Of course, I just immediately said yes, and only afterwards did I reel from shock at what I'd agreed to do, because obviously the brain is a big subject.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's got a bit of range to it, yes. as I've found. Can you possibly summarise it? Can you give us a rough guide to the rough guide to the brain?
I can give you a very rough guide
can
to
you
the
give
rough,
a
rough guide.
Guide squared to the brain?
It is, in a nutshell, an attempt to condense the entire evolution, history of brain science, function and future of the brain into a single book.
Yeah, a pretty big nutshell.
I mean, that was the thing. That was why it was such a shocking undertaking when I started doing it, because for a start, you have to imagine, okay, where do you begin?
That's exactly what I was about to ask. Yes, where do you begin?
Where do you begin with evolution? Hmm. Why is it that the human being has such a large, complicated, amazing brain? And then, of course, you get to think about, well, how do we come to understand what we now know about the brain? And so then you have to discuss a little bit about some of the pioneers of understanding the brain, you know, from Leonardo da Vinci to Ramon y Cajal and all these other people, Thomas Willis, who had this amazing book and was one of the first people to look at the anatomy of the brain proper. But, you know, after you've covered all those basics and a little bit of very straightforward, simple anatomy, you then move on to the stuff that a lot of people might find particularly interesting, like how does memory work? Mm. What is consciousness? Other things like, you know, well, what happens when the brain goes wrong? Mm. So there's a whole chapter dedicated to the mysteries of, you know, mental illness, personality disorders. There's a chapter dedicated to how do particular drugs affect the brain. And when I say drugs, I'm not just talking about illicit drugs, I'm talking about everything.
Yeah.
From exactly. Painkillers.
It's got to be a medicine, really, hopefully.
Absolutely.
There's quite a lot of neuroactive drugs out there, as I know, trust me on this.
Exactly. Yeah.
Speaking of the history of this sort of understanding the brain, where did you, in your research, where did you find it was a good place to start from in history? Because, I mean, a lot of people probably don't realise that it was quite late on in human societal development that we actually realised the brain is as important as it is.
Exactly.
For a while, it was the heart, and the brain was just a way of cooling blood for some people.
Yeah.
Where did you sort of start on the historical side of things?
I suppose I started properly about the 1500s with people like Thomas Willis, who was one of the first people to really try and characterise the anatomy of the brain. Not just what it looks like, but by cutting up, actually analysing what each particular part of the brain looks like. And of course he had people working with him like Sir Christopher Wren, who was able to do the drawings for this book. So this book's effectively considered a masterpiece in neuroscience, quite rightly.
The Renaissance art boom was really quite a boon to science, which a lot of people don't think to realise. Like, was it, not Vesalius, but anatomical guy, just like such detailed drawings, such precision, which you can then show to other people rather than having to get a fresh corpse every time, which people aren't really keen to look at.
Well, absolutely, yeah. Between the drawings that were done, and then, of course, you had Town, who was the one who later on, I think around the 1800s, was doing the wax models of the brain and such.
Plastication, yeah.
Absolutely, because of all these processes that then allowed people to not have to go around cutting up bodies all the time.
So you mentioned like the history stuff, but also you've got different parts of the brain, like sort of how a brain goes wrong. Did you dwell much in the book on sort of parts of neuroscience and brain studies which turned out to, let's just say, not be wrong per se, but like when like the whole like myth about 10% of the brain that people use, that's not true. That's a misnomer. And also phrenology is probably the most famous one.
Yeah, Franz Josef Gall came up with this idea for phrenology, and yes, today he's a character that I often think gets a rather unfair bag, if you like, because even though the idea of having certain personality attributes attributed to particular parts of the skull was wrong.
It's the skull, I think, is the main problem there, isn't it?
Precisely, yeah. But the fundamental idea of regional specialisation of the brain was absolutely spot on. Hmm. So, yes, if you extend his idea to the workings of the brain, it was wrong. But the core idea was absolutely right. And I think that's important for people to remember. And I do mention things like the myths of the brain, like using 10% of the brain and stuff like that, which of course, well, not of course, but it's just fundamentally wrong. I think what people probably don't use enough is their ability to attend to things, to problems.
Yes.
So there's this idea, you know, today we've all got our smartphones, we've got our computers, we've got email, all these things trying to get our attention. And of course that can give us the impression of not being particularly useful or good at achieving particular tasks. In actuality, I think what people, all they need to do is do one thing at a time, and they'll be doing it a lot better. But yeah, fundamentally, the idea of 90% of the brain not being used, absolute rubbish.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad that's on the record finally. I've said it plenty of times, but he's an expert, guys. This book is actually, I would assume it's aimed at a layperson, someone who doesn't have any background in neuroscience, but actually just an interest, could pick up this book and read it and understand it.
Absolutely. I mean, when I was writing this book, people that I had in my mind were my parents, neither of whom have been to university, neither of whom have done science.
Yeah, exactly the same here.
Yeah, so, you know, I would come home and I would talk to them about what I was doing. They would look at me slightly baffled, and that was largely how I spent my formative years. When I got an opportunity to write this book, I was very conscious of the fact that this has to be something that everyone can access. I'm talking to people like my parents who don't simply know this information, and I want them to be able to understand it because it's fascinating.
Do you find, or did you find at all, that when it comes to neuroscience, because I think it is an intrinsically complex subject, I mean, it's not really intuitive to a certain degree. It's not like sort of ABC. It's not like a Lego block so you can see how it works, because the brain is such a complex system. It's evolved. It hasn't been designed for, you know, ease of interface. Do you find it got to the point where you have to sort of make a decision between making something clear and making something accurate?
No.
No? Cool. No, only, a simple and concise that answer was as well.
Only, an expert. Only in the sense that it depends on the level of detail that you want to go into.
Yeah.
So yes, I do talk about how nerve cells communicate with each other, but I don't go into the level of detail that you would get in a textbook about
it. It's not
because,
for that.
Exactly, because it's simply not necessary for somebody to understand which way calcium is flowing across the membrane of a nerve cell. They don't need to know that. But also, you say the brain, and really what the brain is a human being. So rather than talking about or getting too immersed in the structure of the brain, the book is largely about what the brain allows us to do. So, for example, memory is one of the most fascinating aspects of how the human mind works, how it's able to travel through time, how any given individual is able to recollect events from their childhood and share those events with somebody else in another point in time. Sharing with people how memory actually works, I think, is something that most people would want to know. Yeah. I think most people are probably interested in what is consciousness. There's big questions about how their own mind works and how they see the world. I'd be amazed if almost everybody doesn't know somebody who at some point in their life has experienced some kind of mental illness, whether it's depression or bipolar disorder. And it's very useful for people to be able to look at a book which can explain what those things are in a way that's not patronising, where they can find out more information about it, but also doesn't go into so much detail that they're perplexed.
Actually, yeah, speaking of it, this is the second edition of Rough Guide to the Brain. What particular changes have you made? Not to give any spoilers here, if anyone wants to buy both and compare and contrast.
A fundamental change that you make, when Rough Guide came back to me and said they'd like to do another edition, bearing in mind that the first one came out in 2007, it did seem like a fairly logical thing to do, because 4 or 5 years or so in neuroscience is actually, at the moment, quite a long time.
Like dog years, isn't it?
Absolutely. And there are other branches of science, perhaps, that you would look at, and not too much might change in that level of time. But for neuroscience in particular, with the advent of neuroimaging and how popular that's become as a way of seeing into the mind as it's actually working, things have changed a lot. So one of the things that I did to the new edition of the book was effectively just go through the entire volume and update it with new findings that have come along. For example, in the case of memory that we've been talking about, there's a new protein. It doesn't particularly matter what the protein's called, but they've discovered that there's just one protein in the brain that fundamentally allows us to create long-term memories. And if you block that protein, the function of that protein, in essence, your memories could just vanish. Things like that, absolutely fascinating. But also what they wanted to do was to introduce a new chapter. So we had a bit of a chat about what that chapter could be, and one of the things that I'd been playing with was the idea of technology in the brain. You know, we live in a world today where we have the internet, television, video games, mobile phones. How do these things impact on our mind?
I mean, we're on surgical testing away from being cyborgs, really, aren't we? I mean, we're very close to that now. Everything we've got is technologically based on our personal old times. So
absolutely.
It's going to really just go that way.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that's introduced in this edition of the book is talking about, well, I don't call it cybernetics at the time, but I'm talking about retinal implants, corneal implants, brain-machine interfacing, all these things that several years ago, would have seemed like science fiction, but they are now practical applications for placing machines in connection with the human nervous system. And as you say, I think that's only going to rise.
At some point, you might ask people just downloading this podcast just by thinking about it, which...
I've got to admit, being a bit of a geek, I think that would be really cool.
Yeah, I'm a fan of that. I think I'm ready for pro-GM food. I want some blue tomatoes. I'm quite happy about that idea. Okay, so that's basically a rough guide to the brain. Anything else you'd like to add, Barry?
Well, I think we've kind of covered it, but the whole point of the book is that anybody who has never read anything about the brain or been put off by the subject matter of the brain because they thought it was too complex, this is not that book. This is a book that you can pick up and you can sit down and you can just take in a chapter on anything that takes your mind. You can look at the future of the brain. You can look at there's even a chapter on the unexplained brain, which and I deliberately decided
probably
to delve.
Chapter, that.
Well, yeah, I do. Yeah, but also to go into an area that many people would be very, very sceptical about as well. So, can you read minds? Is telepathy real? All that kind of stuff. All the kinds of things that you would see in a traditional Derren Brown show. Is there any kind of scientific proof behind it? So there are popular culture elements in the book as well. Really, it's fundamentally designed for anyone.
Well, so if anyone does hear this and anyone wants to buy it, then please do. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for chatting to us.
And that's just about it for this week's Pod Delusion. Before we go, another quick plug for the Coalition for Equal Marriage. There's now only 2 weeks left of the government consultation on equal marriage, and anyone can go and submit their opinions to the government. You don't even have to be gay or even like marriage. So if you'd like to support equal marriage, head over to the Coalition for Equal Marriage's website and follow the links to the consultation. It's very, very important. And you can find links to that on the Pod Delusion website. Also, do head over to the Pod Delusion website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to over 2.5 years of archives, as well as like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, if you're into those sorts of things. And of course, on our website, if you do enjoy this show, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month. We're now picking up the tab for the bandwidth bills directly on the podcast downloads, which, as you might imagine, can stack up. So please donate £5 or £10 a month or make a one-off donation to help us cover those. You can find links to do so at poddelusion.co.uk. Go on, it's like buying us a couple of drinks a month. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Corey Hazelhurst, Hayley Stevens, Dean Burnett, and me, James O'Malley, with much additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The sketch of the moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Gabriel, you are here under suspicion of being implicit in the thefts of documentation from His Holiness the Pope in a series of events known globally as VatiLeaks.
I'm not nothing.
Mr. Gabriel, why do you sound so much like a gross stereotyping of an Italian?
It's the comedy scriptwriters. They only know Super Mario.
Very well. Paolo Gabriel, it is my intention as judge on this tribunal that I, Paolo Papanti Palettie, must preside over prosecuting the perpetrator of purloined personal papal papers of the pontiff.
Pardon?
I said that I, Paolo Papanti Palettie, must preside over prosecuting the perpetrator of purloined personal papal papers of the pontiff.
I'm no understand.
It's a perfectly plain. I, Paolo Papanti Palettie, must preside...
No, I understand. I'm taking the piece. It's a poppycock. I'm not procured pieces of the Pope's personal paraphernalia. Performing the papal peonage is a privilege.
Producing your plea.
I'm not guilty. I'm not purport to be a paragon of purity and priestliness, but I'm not pick up the pontiff's publications. I'm a once picked a peck of pickled pepper from a person called Peter.
Pardon?
Apologies. I'm a take of the piece again.
Paolo Gabriel, I'm persuaded you are pristine in the performance of your part and no purloiner of personal papal paperwork. You are free to go. Now, what else are we looking at today?
Apparently, Your Eminence, the Sheikh's sixth sheep is sick.
Oh, shut up.